Hello, and welcome to another bonus episode of the Holistic Trauma Healing Podcast that is exclusively available to you as a Circle member. These episodes are a deeper dive down the holistic trauma healing rabbit hole. You will find yourself challenged, empowered, inspired, and maybe even a little bit uncomfortable. But remember, we're getting to the root of how trauma has affected every aspect of your existence, and that's not always quick or easy. By being part of the Trauma Healer Circle, you are already consciously creating your best possible reality and weaving a new web of life that isn't ruled by the past. I'm so honored you're in my circle. Welcome back to another bonus episode. Thank you for being here. So I have Maria Paredes from episode 38 here. In episode 38, we talked about eating disorders and the nervous system and healing trauma. And in this, I just kept the tape rolling and we went off on a few tangents, a few rabbit trails about food addiction. Sorry, my dogs are barking. Food addiction, hyperpalatable foods, and just existential life questions. Like, why are we even worried about all of this food and all of these things and controlling our bodies and trying to manipulate our health to live longer? Why aren't we just enjoying where we're living and what we're doing right now? And like, she and I definitely, you'll be able to hear in this conversation, we definitely did not agree on everything, but there was so much mutual respect and compassion between the two of us that even though we don't really answer any questions in this episode, I'll be honest, you're not going to turn this episode off and being like, holy shit, I just learned something really fucking amazing and now I can apply it to my life. That was not what this episode was. This was just us chit-chatting as friends about something that is very difficult to chat with or to chat about on like social media. Like, one of the reasons why I created the circle was because I believe that social media is not for community. I believe that hard conversations and hard topics that are very real and things that we really need to figure out are important, but having those conversations on social media is not leading us anywhere. Like, we're literally just going in circles. The snake is eating its own tail and we're not getting anywhere. And so she and I we're having a couple of those conversations on here that you do in community where no one necessarily walks away with the answer, but you walk away knowing like, hey, I found a safe person to talk about a really hard topic with, and that's maybe all I needed. So that's what this episode is. We talk about some food addiction, food accessibility, hyperpalatable foods, and existential life questions. Enjoy. I have some notes here that I think would make a really good bonus episode that I give to my members if you're interested in doing that.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to talk about, I didn't want to share this in the public episode because I don't even know if I have the vocabulary to have the conversation yet. But since you're a person who is like an expert in this, I wanted to ask you. So I've seen circulating this idea about how like highly palatable food and how it shouldn't be allowed because it's causing people to get addicted to food. Are you familiar with what I'm talking about?
Is that food addiction or like what do you?
Yeah, I guess I'm talking about food addiction, but I've seen a couple of people, they're mutual friends of ours online, and I don't want to name them here, but I've seen them talking about how like the food industry making these hyper palatable foods, high fat, high salt, high sugar foods, especially in combination. So foods that have a lot of fat and a lot of sugar or a lot of fat and a lot of salt, being like capitalizing on our predisposition to crave these foods and to want more of these foods, the more of them that we eat. And those types of foods need to be like regulated better or like even not produce anymore because they're too palatable and they're leading to food addictions. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about.
Okay. Can we talk about that? Because I don't know that this necessarily has a connection to trauma or not. I'm sure I could probably find a connection if I thought about it long enough. But as somebody who is just as interested in like psychology and polyvagal theory as I am food and like nutrition, to me, the intersection of this is it's too interesting to ignore. And I'm just curious about it.
Yeah. So like Okay. So one thing I'll say is I'm going to send people on in a direction where you can learn more. If you Google Marcy Evans, MarciEvans, Marcy Evans and food addiction, you will come up with podcast episodes and articles and all sorts of things. That is a dietitian, she's based in Boston, who has expertise in this area. I am one in general, like we talked earlier, like one of my biggest values is being curious. And one of my biggest values is knowing that I don't know stuff. So I'm always open to being proven wrong. My frame of reference is in treating people with disordered eating and body image. So when I say my expertise is in helping people through this, that's where I'm coming from. And so I can tell you that like many of our clients, when they initially call, will say, I have food addiction or some version of that. And then we do the work and it just isn't there. It really is that they have an eating disorder, disordered eating, or it's just that they're feeding themselves. Like truly, it's just that they're feeding themselves. In the addiction world, I think it's a super helpful lens to frame a lot of things through addiction. We now have gaming addiction, sex addiction. There's a lot of different things. I have not seen the research on food addiction pan out clearly enough to believe that's what's happening. In part because like one argument that's often said is has common, you know, drug pathways in the brain. Those same pathways light up when you get hugs, when you breathe. So I'm addicted to hugs. I'm addicted to breathing. So to me, that's not good evidence just to begin with. There's a lot of, we could name a lot of things that light up in those same areas of the brain. That doesn't mean that we're addicted to food. And in a similar way too, to say we're addicted to something that we need to survive, I think that's a really, I'm trying to think of the right word. I don't want you to say the wrong word. I just think that's a dangerous trail to go down.
Yeah, right? Dangerous was the word that I was thinking too.
Yeah. And when I say that, I do not mean that hyperbolically. Is that the word? I say that as someone who I work with are people with life-threatening eating disorders, are people who come in thinking they're addicted to food of all different sizes and shapes. And what I can say that I've seen in my clinical experience, and I teach and train dietitians and therapists across the country, Canada, Australia too, I can tell you that what I've seen be more harmful to people in the relationship with food and body is thinking that they have food addiction than actually having this thing that they're thinking is food addiction, if that makes sense. Like being afraid of food, feeling like you have to restrict food, I think is more harmful than anything. And so then too, if we go to, so there's things that we could pull apart in terms of why are people saying that, yes, it's the same thing as this, right? It doesn't pan out, I don't think, completely in this direction, but from a treatment perspective, like just going to treatment perspective, okay, what do we know about treatment? Because I'm not disagreeing with the idea that there are things in food, that there are substances being put in food to create the palatability. I'm not arguing with that. There's absolutely things that the food industry is doing, right?
And it's criminal. Like I think it's criminal to add those things into food. Not only like MSG, for example, MSG increases the palatability of food. It like makes your brain think that it tastes better than it actually does. And it's also a known neurotoxin. So not only is it getting us to want to eat more, but it's also poisoning our brains. So in that way, those types of additives, like I do agree, those things should be banned. Like they don't belong in food. They're not something that the human body needs inside of it to live. That's not how we nourish ourselves. Like totally agree with you on that one.
I don't know that I'm agreeing with all of that. Like I'm not disagreeing with all that.
Yeah, sure.
From a treatment perspective, I think it has been a really harmful thing to create fear in people about what food they have. And when we look at it, even from an access to food, generally speaking, the folks who have access to food without MSG, this gets into whole areas of discrimination and oppression and all that. So are there things that need to be done in terms of the absolute food industry? But I don't think that it helps for us to be afraid or to even use words like poison sometimes. I can tell you, I've seen that come out in family sessions, in clients where, you know, they are so scared because they're hearing these words, whether from their parents or from a health teacher at school or from whatever, that creates such fear and such disruption in their ability to eat. I'd also say from a treatment perspective, when someone has disordered eating of any kind, restriction never helps. It is always harmful. And so like an abstinence model, which is the more common model in addiction models. It's not the only model. There are harm reduction models, but an abstinence model applied to food, whether we're talking, and I've been to OA before, Lindsay, like years and years ago. I went to OA. At one point I thought, oh, maybe I'm addicted to food. Like I say this not from ignorance. The idea, like if you go to OA, what they're often encouraging is like abstinence from either food in general or from a particular food or food group. It could be like flour or whatever it is. And that we know, we have lots of evidence that that is harmful to people and that's not going to help heal disordered eating and body image concerns, that it's going to do the opposite. And two, like a lot of the research too around food addiction does not control for like when you're looking at the brain lighting up, it doesn't control for restriction. And so one of the things that people are asking for to come out in some of this food addiction research is, can we control for, if we control for restriction, what happens? Does it, is the brain lighting up because it's been restricted and then has food? Or is it this like more simplified food addiction model where it's just ooh, food and the brain lights up? Deprivation, when you're deprived of something and then you get it, right? Your brain releases certain hormones, right? That feels good. If I haven't had something and then I have it, it's like holding your breath underwater and finally getting a good breath. It feels good. If you've not eaten for a long time and then you finally eat. Yeah. It doesn't matter what you're eating. If you haven't eaten in a long time and then you eat, you could be eating something really not that great. And it's going to taste better even without anything added to it, because that's a response to having been deprived and then being able to eat. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thanks for offering that correction about me saying that's poisonous. I do believe, for me personally, I don't eat food with MSG, and it's not because I'm trying to restrict that food. It's because it's literally made me sick. Like I ate it when I was pregnant.
I trust that what your body needs, and I think it's great that you have the ability to listen to that and do that. Majority of people don't, and I agree. There's a lot that needs to be done with food, but I would say where we need the most done, there have been some efforts that I feel like have clouded over an emphasis on maybe like kind of food addiction stuff and like getting certain things out of food. And there is so much more that needs, if we look at it from like a Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we need to first just increase food, right? There are people, like I live in an area where we have one of the highest food deserts in the country. A lot of people don't know, folks with food insecurity actually have a higher likelihood of developing disordered eating and body image concerns. So I'm not saying it's not important to look at that. I'm saying we have so much more else that we need to begin with. We need to first increase access to food. We need to first just have people just have enough food. I don't fucking care if there's MSG in there.
Yeah.
Seriously though, like my kids go, the school they go to, it's like they're in a magnet school and it's in like a neighborhood, Section 8 housing, very impoverished. And because the majority of the kids there are below a certain income, they have free lunch, like everyone in the school. They don't separate it out because they don't want there to be this like difference. So everyone has lunch for free. They also have breakfast for free, and they often will provide dinners. And during the summer, they'll often provide lunch because there is so much food insecurity. There's such a lack of access to food. And when you look at the food, yeah, you're going to see that there's a lot of food that might be highly palatable, that might whatever. And who fucking cares? They have food, right? I don't mean who fucking cares. There's not. I just mean like there are more important things that we need to put focus on before we even get to that. We need to make sure that people just even have access to food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Sorry, I can get on a soapbox about that.
No, it's fine. It's totally fine. I want to circle back around to the hyper palatable because I have an article here. This is a Medscape article. I'll link to it in the show notes about hyper palatable foods defined as foods driving the obesity epidemic. And so they actually have like percentages of fat, sugar, carbs, and sodium. So like a fat sodium combination is a hyperpalatable food where more than 25% of the calories come from fat and more than 0.3% is sodium by weight. So examples of that are bacon and pizza. And then there's one that's a fat and a simple sugar where more than 20% of the calories come from fat and more than 20% come from sugar. So for example, cake and ice cream and like bread and chips, like donuts, like they have various examples of different foods. And the argument is that because these foods are made in such a way as to light up those centers in your brain that are like, I want more, this is good, this is satisfying, that is increasing
obesity, which we just talked about in the episode before, that obesity is a relative term. So
it's a relative term. The BMI categories were changed in recent years, and it's just not good data. Like, it's when you look at it from a science perspective, it's weight research, when you look at so many of the studies, they often have end sizes that are very small, or they look at very short time periods, and they don't often take in consideration so many other factors that influence the trajectory of bodies and bodies' reaction to experiences. I just want to say, if any, like, y'all, you can have pizza, you can have ice cream, you can have whatever. And oftentimes, knowing more about these things oftentimes will end up being more harmful to people than eating the food itself. I think more times out of not, I think more information, and I'm someone who's like, more information is power, but around food, we know too much. We are being told too much. It's that information that's getting in the way of us being able to intuitively and somatically being able to connect to our food and listen and enjoy food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I guess if I was going to make a connection to trauma, meaning a nervous system dysregulated state that's on a chronic level because your body was unable to process or leave or fight back during a situation, is I've noticed that it seems like, and I definitely noticed this in the health and wellness industry, which I now call toxic wellness culture, the industry of like constantly telling people to restrict certain foods and demonizing certain foods and certain types of diets and whatever else, is it's really common in that space for people who have these chronic health conditions to be always looking outside of themselves. Just tell me what to do. Give me the diet that I'm supposed to be on. Tell me what supplement I need to take. Tell me what practitioner I need to see, what blood work I need to have done. Like, it's this constant search for just trying to fix what's wrong with them. Mm-hmm. And I think that I see that with this hyperpalatability of food causing or leading to air quotes, using all kinds of air quotes here, the obesity epidemic or whatever, is that it seems like always looking for something outside of ourselves to blame on the problem that we perceive is there. And I'm not even saying it's an actual problem. Like, it's a problem that we perceive. And like me, for example, I'll just use myself. Like, I went for 10 years restricting my diet, avoiding gluten, avoiding dairy, experimenting with different quote unquote gut healing protocols, trying different probiotics, going to 10 different practitioners and being on 10 different protocols, doing detoxes, like enema cleanses, like all these things. I spent 10 years doing that in the name of quote unquote healing myself because I had chronic anxiety, chronic insomnia, and chronic pain in my pelvis. Mm-hmm. And what I actually needed was not another diet or another supplement protocol or another practitioner. What I actually needed was an operation to fix the varicose veins in my pelvis. And I needed to deal with my shit. Like, you can't find a supplement to regulate your nervous system. Like, it doesn't exist. But it was easier. It seemed easier if I could just find the right diet or the right supplement or the right whatever, then that's going to fix me and everything's going to be fine. I don't have to worry about this anymore. That seemed easier than doing the excavation work of myself. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think another thing that we could add to that is, and without facing deep existential truths, what I mean when I say that, I'm so fucking glad, Lindsay, that you were able to get that surgery and that it like gave you such relief. Oh my gosh. Some people, they might be dealing with something and they're not able to, there may not be an answer, right? Not even that they just haven't found it. Like, sometimes we just have something and there is no answer and that fucking sucks.
But it's the human experience, unfortunately.
That's what I mean. And it brings me back to like how important grief is in this. I was a child adolescent grief counselor at our local hospice years ago, named a place called Kids Path. And something that was so interesting when I worked there is that people would ask me like, what do you do for a living? And I'd be like, oh, I'm a grief counselor. And literally, Lindsay, people would cross their arms and take a step back. It's almost like they thought they could catch it. Like, you're not going to catch grief just like talking to me. And then they would say something like, oh my gosh, that must be so sad. I cry all the time, whatever. And actually for me, it was one of the most energizing places I've worked, because when people, like, there's no way to hide from death. I couldn't be like, oh, your mom's not going to die. Or sometimes the kids themselves had terminal illness. Oh, you're this isn't real. You're not going to whatever. Or your grandpa will come back from death. It's real. So there's no hiding behind it. And when people, when that's the case, when people are at end of life or they're dealing with death, there's nothing to hide behind. So they're more open. And I think about that with all of this, because a lot of this, I love that term you used, right? The toxic wellness, something industry.
Toxic wellness culture.
Toxic wellness culture, right? Like it's all this seeking purity. And at the root of it is, in certain ways, we're trying to seek the Holy Grail, the fountain of youth. We're trying to escape this thing that ultimately we have no control of. None of us have control over when we're going to die. And when we really sit with that, like not in some intellectual way, when like we really sit, I don't know if you've ever done this, Lindsay. I know you've talked about some of the, I listened to one of your first podcasts. You've been in dark places, right?
Yeah. A little bit.
Okay. Like when you really sit with that, those deep existential questions of death and living and meaning and purpose, like why do these things happen? It's really fucking hard. It's painful. And sometimes it's so hard and painful that we have no control over it. Ultimately, I have no control over when I'm going to die or when my kids are going to die or how people perceive me. And that, if we really sit with it, that can really fuck with you. And it's scary. So much so that we do so much to push it away. Think about some of the things, like even like in those industries, age-defying mascara, like what? Like mascara that's it's going to make me live longer? Like really?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I know what they mean. I'm joking. But like truly, like it, all of this stuff, we're trying to avoid this truth. I like getting old. I feel more confident and more at home in my body and less anxious, less hypervigilant the older I get. And I don't know. I just feel like that this like eternal search for this like answer is keeping us spinning. And then we look back and it's like, oh my gosh, all these years, all this energy, all this time, all these times with friends, I could have just been enjoying life. And instead I like didn't go because I didn't like how I looked, or I didn't go because I felt like I was too much of this or too little of this. I don't know. It's just, here we are. We're living in this moment. How can we be here and not be constantly searching for the answer? Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100%. Totally. And something, I can't remember who told me this, my husband, my friend, maybe it was my mom. I think it might have been my mom. But all those years I was eating healthy and, or healthy in air quotes there, and doing all these things to manipulate and try to hack into my body and whatever. And I think she was like, Lindsay, you could do all of this and achieve perfect health and still die in a car wreck. And that was like a, oh shit, you're right. And yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying. I just find the since we were talking about food, this hyperpalatability thing is a new concept for me. That's not something I've ever heard of before. And then whenever I was reading about it and learning that it's like different ratios of like calories from fat and calories from sugar or how much salt something has in it, I was just thinking to myself like, yeah, I guess fast food could fall into this category. But at the time when I was reading this article, I was eating a salad in front of me, and I was like looking at the different parts of my plate of my salad, and I was like, but I think my salad could fall into that category too, because my dressing has a lot of fat in it, and I put boiled eggs on my salad, which have fat in them, and I have seeds on my salad, which have fat in them, and I put like a hefty dose of everything but the bagel seasoning on my whole salad, so it's got a lot of salt. So like, how it's so crazy to me that we're gonna,
your body needs all those things,
right? Right.
Yeah, like our brain needs a lot of fat. And even during pandemic right now, something we've been talking a lot about is our bodies need more right now because they're doing more. When you're in a more hypervigilant state, which in certain ways our whole world is right now because there's this like sort of nebulous threat of coronavirus, our body is working harder in that state. We know that. And so we probably do need more calories. We probably do need more fat to support what is happening. And that's not bad. That's not a failure. That's not weak. That's just, it just is, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's even research that shows like more fat is protective about certain things. So even like Alzheimer's, dementia, fat is not bad. I just want to make sure I say that.
No, we're totally on the same page. And I do want to echo what you're saying about fat being really good for the brain against like Alzheimer's and dementia. Like, the way that I was able to, a big part of my own personal healing journey, healing from anxiety and panic attacks and healing from insomnia, was understanding the brain injury caused by trauma. like the actual brain injury caused by trauma, and then taking steps to nourish my brain with healthy fats to reduce the inflammation in my brain. And there's nothing more anti-inflammatory for the brain than healthy fats, which is why keto is prescribed for people with epilepsy and seizures, because that's an it's an inflammation of the brain. And the keto diet, because it's so high in fat, it calms the inflammation. And so I take super high doses of fish oil and olive oil like every day. And I've been doing it for a year. And in the last year, I've been able to get off of psychiatric medications, and I'm now sleeping like 7 to 9 hours a night. I wasn't able to do that before. And it's because I believe, of course, I've done a lot of other work too. I've done like cold plunges and breath work and meditation, and there's been a lot, but I definitely cannot discount that like fat has been such an important part of my own journey, and just like appreciating that fat is a natural substance and that it occurs in food naturally. And it's good for me because it can't occur naturally and be bad. I don't think. I don't know. Just talking out my ass here.
We need fat. I'm with you. We need fat.
Yeah. Bottom line.
Yeah. No, yes. And sometimes it's just so sad to me that we have demonized so many things, right? Like, and even this pursuit, we're talking about the pursuit to live longer. Like, we are living longer. We're living like double as long as like our ancestors used to live. You know what I mean? Like, we're living way past we're supposed to live. And yet there's this pressure, like we need to like do all these things to make sure that it's like, can we just chill and enjoy life right now? Like, I would rather live right now, enjoy life right now, than this constant pursuit to try to elongate life.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. Do you think that because trauma heightened sensitivity in your nervous system, feeling dysregulated, if you're hyper aroused, you're feeling anxious, if you're hypo aroused, you're feeling depressed. So you've got these spectrums of extreme or whatever, both of which in my experience prevent you from being present in this moment, like being hyper aroused or hypo aroused. Both of those states, it's very difficult to be present in this moment, and in my experience. And I think that like constantly trying to evade death or prolong life is actually preventing us from being present in this moment, because we're like always living in the future. And I think that there are roots in trauma of that. If we knew who we were like as spiritual beings, at least this is what I believe, if we knew who we were as spiritual beings, that like energy doesn't ever go away, it just changes forms, and my physical body is gonna die, but my consciousness or whatever I believe is gonna go back and join the galaxy or the stars, or it's gonna reincarnate as something else or whatever. It can't go away because it's energy, and energy just changes forms. It doesn't disappear. So when I figured that out, especially after getting out of religion, it was like I wasn't afraid of dying anymore, because I don't feel like that death is the end. It just means I'm going to change forms, or at least that's what I believe.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
Yeah.
I don't know that I have an answer. Like, it sounds good. Like, I just, I don't know, my own spiritual beliefs are constantly evolving and growing. And like, when I was listening to you, I just think no matter what, like whatever the answer is or whatever the truth is, here we are, I think, in a way. And so like right now I'm enjoying talking with Lindsay. And I know for me, when I'm stuck in replaying the past or in catastrophizing about the future, I'm not doing anything. I'm not even in the past, present, or future, because I'm not really in the past. I'm not really in the future. And I'm certainly not in the present. And so I don't know. I just feel like, how do we slow down and just be where we are, if that makes sense? Like, here we are. I don't know what's going to happen after I die, but here I am right now. And so what can I do right now?
Yeah. And I may be totally wrong. I may believe the wrong thing, but I guess the upside of it is that I'm no longer like walking around with the Bible, knocking on people's doors and trying to evangelize them into it.
Those people. For you, Lindsay, maybe it was like a month ago. It was like a post that Kenzie did, and it was like a series of like pictures, and it was like, this is you, and it was like this little dot out in the galaxy, and then it was like, this is you, and it was like a close-up of the galaxy, like this is you. It was like the Earth, and the whole point was like, we're stardust. All this intellectualizing and all this trying to figure out the answer, and this is a little bit of what I heard from you, is like, at the end of the day, we don't even fucking know, and we truly are stardust, right? We are just gas. Like, yeah, with teeth that come out of our mouths or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So calm down, y'all. Just
I'm getting this really amazing image of a ball of gas with teeth
that used to go give me the rounds maybe a couple of years ago. And it was like, we're just like flesh covered skeletons circling the sun or something. And it was like, that's true. That's all true. Like we're just, and we all think we have the answer. And I just, sometimes I just want to be like, chill out, y'all. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I tell you what, everybody can do their own thing. But for me, it was like a couple of psychedelic trips taught me that's really all I needed to know. It was like, actually, I am just a tiny little speck floating amongst a bunch of other tiny little specks. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't fucking matter. And I am small and insignificant in the grand scheme of things. And sometimes my problems can feel really big, but really they're not. And this too shall pass. It'll either pass in my lifetime or it'll be over when I die. But one way or another, this will pass. Oh my gosh. This was awesome. Thank you for staying after to just chit chat with me about these things. This is really fun. I think my circle members are really going to enjoy this. Yeah. So thank you so much.
All right. Bye, Lindsay.
I do think that Dr. Maria Paredes is one of the world's leading experts for therapy and recovering from eating disorders and body shame and body hate. So if that's something that you or someone you love is dealing with, then I will have links in the show notes of this episode where you can connect with Maria or anyone on her team at Three Birds Counseling and get help and healing. She knows her stuff when it comes to the nervous system and health at every size and body image and disordered eating. So if that's something that you or someone you know is dealing with, please, please, please check the show notes of this episode. Links for all of that will be in those show notes. And thank you for being here. Thank you for being part of my circle. And I will talk to you next time.